Safety Policy and Finance. Today, February 17, 2005. Clerk, would you take the roll? Here.
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 He's here.
I'm here.
Tamar.
Here.
Chair notes that we do have a presence of a quorum, so therefore the first item we'll look at are the consideration of the minutes from the February 16th meeting, 2005. Clerk, note that on the minutes that I'm looking at have a different date. Any discussion on the minutes? Questions? Representative Newman moves approval of the minutes. Any discussion? If not, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. We have two bills for consideration today. We'll go to those right away, and it's my intent that we would hear them and then lay them on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill later on. Representative Paymar, House File 443, Employer Retaliation Protection for Crime Victims. Morning.
Chair, members, I'd like to move House File 443 for possible inclusion in the omnibus crime bill. Chair, members, just briefly explain what the bill does and then have my witnesses testify, and then I'll be happy to stand for questions. Basically, there's three changes that we're making here that currently in current law, the only time that an employee is protected from retaliation against an employer is if they're subpoenaed to testify in court. And what we're doing here is making some modifications to 518B, which is the Domestic Abuse Act, which would say that if there was a victim of domestic violence who sought an order for protection, that they would be able to, by giving a reasonable advance notice to the employer, would be able to take unpaid leave to go and obtain that civil order for protection or any court hearings subsequent to that without the possibility of retaliation. So that's one component, and that is in Section 1 of the bill. And then in Section 2 of the bill, this modifies or amends 609748, which is the harassment and restraining order, and it's basically the same language that prohibits an employer from retaliating against an employee for seeking a harassment or restraining order. And it sets forth penalties in both cases that an employer could be charged with a misdemeanor, and also there could be civil remedies for back pay and wages. This language we took from the employee retaliation language in 611A, so it's the exact same language. If a victim or the witness is subpoenaed or requested by the prosecutor to attend a court for the purpose of giving testimony, is guilty of a misdemeanor, may be punished for contempt of court. And then, Mr. Chair and members, the third part of the bill deals with an employer who employee who wants to take time off of work to attend court proceedings if a family member has been a victim of a heinous crime. And this would allow a next of kin or a parent to witness those proceedings. And the same penalties would be employed here if there was a violation of that right under this legislation. So with that, I'd like to demonstrate a couple of problems that are out there and hence the need for the bill. I'd like to introduce Connie Larson, who will tell her story.
Before you do that, are there any questions from the committee of the author on the language of the bill? If not, there is. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Paymar, do you know what the definition of next of kin is under the law? I don't. I'm not trying to get you. I'm just curious.
I'd ask Rebecca to draft that language to...
We'll ask.
I can come back to that if you want.
I also have the possibility of an amendment when we're all done, because I realized there was a... this is sort of narrow, and there might also be some room for victims of crime, period, to be able to, crimes of violence, I should say, that should be able to attend a hearing. Right now, we've limited it to those victims of heinous crimes, which is first-degree murder, second-degree murder, third-degree murder, and first and second, thirds, crim sex offenses.
Ms. Pierce, do you have a definition on the next of kin?
I do, Chair and Representative Johnson. It's not defined in statute currently, but under common law, the definition of next of kin is the nearest living blood relation.
Okay. Representative Newman, did you have a question of the author?
I do. Thank you, Chair. Mr. Chair. Representative Paymar, going to page 4, subdivision 7, I think there you're talking about allowing an employee to get off as the next of kin to attend court proceedings. And my question is, sometimes a trial for a heinous crime could become quite lengthy. If an employer were to allow an employee to take off time even without pay, that could be, conceivably could become a real burden on an employer to have an employee gone for an extended period of time. Is there any protection in here at all for an employer under those kinds of circumstances?
Representative Paymar.
Well, we did try to balance it as best we could with language saying that, that the employee should give a reasonable advance notice, some other aspects that we could put in, other components we put in here, that the employee shall provide verification that supports the employee's reason for being absent from the workplace. I don't disagree with you, Representative Newman, that it could be problematic in certain situations, but I would add that this is really a small consideration to victims of both crime as well as family members who've had children or other family members killed, and I really wanted to go take a much broader approach. For instance, in Illinois, they have what's called the Victims Economic Security and Safety Act, and this applies to victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, or stalking, and it allows an employee who is a victim to take unpaid leave for up to 12 weeks to a year. So other states have really addressed this victims' rights issue a lot broader than Minnesota has. We have in current law, there's really no way that a family member or a victim can protect themselves from any retaliation from an employer. So I think this is, if you have some language that you think might be helpful to the employer, I don't know that we want to put time limits on it, but I'd be open to considering it.
One follow-up question.
Representative Newman.
Sure. And believe me, I appreciate where you're coming from, and I'm not opposing this, but I do then go back into Subdivision 6, and there's some pretty stiff civil penalties that are provided, including reimbursement for attorney's fees. I will give it some thought, Representative Paymar, but somehow we have to try and be fair to both sides here. So that So we don't have an abuse, is what I'm talking about.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Kamar.
Representative Newman, again, we took this language right out of Minnesota statute in terms of the situation where an employer retaliated against an employee who was subpoenaed or requested by the prosecutor to attend court for purpose of giving testimony. This language is exact, right out of Minnesota statute. We're just applying it to victims of orders for protection and family members who want to observe a court hearing where a family member has been killed in a heinous crime.
Anything further?
Nothing further.
Well, just as a reminder to all of us, Representative Newman and Tamar and myself, that's one of the reasons we lay these bills on the table, not just to put them someplace until we kill them later or advance them later, but it gives all of us time to digest what we're seeing today and polish it if it needs polishing and work it, help it along or not. So any other questions of the author before we go to your testimony? Why don't you proceed with that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Connie Larson. I'm from Waseca. My daughter, Callie Jo Larson, 12 years old, was murdered in our home April 20th, 1999. At the time, I was employed full-time as a social worker in a nursing home for about 4 years at that time. I was called at work when my daughter was murdered and immediately went home from there. I did take advantage of the Family Medical Leave Act and took a few months off. My employer did allow that, of course, and they were very good for me. What happened when I came back to work in August or September, I was also under the care of a psychiatrist, and my employer worked with my counselors and to get me back into full-time work again. And I did do that successfully by October. Subsequently, the perpetrator was caught and a grand jury was going to be summoned in the spring of 2000, and I was subpoenaed by the grand jury to testify. I presented that to my employer, and her attitude was, well, we'll see about that. And I also had to lay out to her what was coming up in the future as far as court hearings and the trial and what we were looking at. She was not supportive in my attending that or my taking time off. I didn't have any accumulated time because I'd been back to work a short time, and benefits and for a lot of us are minimal. So I hadn't accumulated any time to take off. I did have the assistance of the Attorney General's Office, the BCA, the Chief of Police, and the State Office of Crime Victim Services to talk with my employer about the need for me to attend not only the grand jury, having a subpoena, of course, but to try to convince them that I should have some time off should a trial pursue. There was never really an agreement that that would happen until the main office was located, which is out of state, and they immediately accepted everything and were going to allow me some time off. I think if I didn't have the connections that I had as a crime victim, this would not have been a favorable outcome for me. Subsequently, there was a lot of relationships went downhill from there. There were other things that came up, and really I felt that my job was threatened in a lot of different ways. And thankfully, a few months later, another job opportunity came along that I was able to take, and I left that employment. But I really feel that as a crime victim, there is so much at stake because you need to move on with your life. Society wants you to get back into the swing of things, and you really want to do that, but when a trial comes up or when the hearing comes up or as the investigation is going along, you're also part of that. And if you have to give up some of your job time if the employer is also threatening that you may not be able to keep your job, that is just more than a person can really bear. And I really appreciate this bill that speaks to that. I think that it should be common compassion, kindness, and mercy that an employer would show to a crime victim of a heinous crime when this is happening, that it's no fault of their own, but they do need to attend those things. It's something that has to be done. And yet you don't want your livelihood taken away from you either. I think that's another victimization for the family. So, thank you.
Representative Eastman, questions?
Representative Paymar, a lot of places in here you refer to reasonable time off work. That's kind of up to the courts to decide, I guess, what that is. But is that time off work without pay or with pay?
Mr. Chair. Representative Paymar.
Representative Eastman, without pay.
Without pay. Okay, then the second question is on the top of page 2 there in section C, and then on the top of page 3, it talks about the damages that can be recovered, and then it kind of ends by saying total damages recoverable under this subdivision shall not exceed lost wages for 6 weeks. But one of the items in there is including reasonable attorney's fees and that sort of thing. So is that the total damage that could be awarded? It's just lost wages, so attorney's fees couldn't be collected then if that exceeded the lost wages?
Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, I believe both.
I appreciate the clarification. If it is both, then would you be willing to put in some language in here that would say that should the suit be unsuccessful, that the employee would be liable for the employer's attorney's fees?
I think that you can answer that, Representative Paymar, and we'll see where it goes, but this may be something that... Well, let's go ahead and answer the question. I'll just remain silent.
Let me think on that while my next witness provides some testimony.
We have Representative Cornish, then Newman. Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Paymar, one thing that bothers me a little bit is it seems like we're mixing PELRA and 179A or 43A and criminal law in page 2 and line 29, when we're not only finding guilty of a misdemeanor, part of the adjudication would be shall pay back wages and offer job reinstatement. We're getting into a decision that seemed like would be made by an arbitrator in an employment law case here, so we're just mixing the civil with criminal punishment and kind of usurping another court's authority, it seems like. It's just something to think about if we're going to lay it on the table anyway, maybe looking at that.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Paymar.
I just want to clarify again. This is current law. The language that we, and Rebecca, if you want to maybe add to this, that's essentially we took the language that's in 611A036 and just broadened it to these different aspects. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, you're just moving it from one statute.
Yes.
To the others.
It's in current Minnesota law. Mm-hmm. So I'm not creating something new here. We're just expanding it to victims of who want to obtain a civil order for protection, take time off of work, and are prohibited from that, or in Ms. Larson's case, wanted to participate in the court hearing when her daughter was killed. But okay. It's current state law. I'm not recreating anything.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In keeping with Chairman Smith's observations as to why we lay these things on the table, Representative Paymar, when I asked my question about damages, I had not read through the bill where we were limiting damages to 6 weeks worth of wages, and I don't see anything at all unreasonable about that, including the request for attorney's fees. I was concerned about unlimited damages, emotional distress, that type of thing. So I don't see any problem with the bill with that in line. I just didn't see it before.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I didn't explain the bill very carefully. So, Mr. Chair, this is Jill Abernathy.
Ma'am, good morning. Give us your name and then go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Thank you for allowing me to be here. My name is Jill Abernathy. I am a battered woman's advocate with the Domestic Abuse Intervention Project in Duluth, Minnesota. I have worked with women for over 15 years now, and actually I've seen this problem increasing through the years, that women are in jeopardy of losing their jobs or being penalized for going to court to get an order for protection or an order for harassment. So what I've done is just wanted to give you four of the most recent examples. I'll give her first name and where she works. And I would start with Tony. She works for many years with the law office. She went to court after years of being in this abusive relationship to get an order for protection, and the hearing starts at 8:30 in the morning, but you don't know how long you'll be there, and in this case she was there all day. And her employer's response to that was putting her on a 6-month probation at work, so that would mean she could not miss one day for 6 months. And so if she needed to go back to court, or the respondent called her back to court to modify the order at all, she would not have been able to go. Secondly, I would talk about April, who managed a hotel restaurant. Her case was, it rose to the criminal level, and she had a number of court appearances and would need to meet with the prosecutor, and she simply was fired from that job for missing work. Jenny was a woman with two small children. She was still married but separated and worked at McDonald's. She was in a lot of danger. He was stalking her, and she was fired for going to court. I would just add that with no financial security, she did move back with him and was beaten quite badly shortly after that, and has quite a severe broken wrist and has had a number of surgeries on that. Lastly, I'd use the example of Tammy, who works for an assisted living program in Duluth, and she had scheduled her order for protection hearing on a day that she had off, but it was continued because he had not, this is very common for it to be continued, in this case he had not received notice of the order, and so it was continued for a week. And then, so when she appeared the next week and had to miss work, how they penalized her was to lower her from 32 hours a week to 17 hours. So those are the four examples I will share with you at this time. Thank you.
Ms. Abernathy, thank you for taking the time to be here as well. Any questions of the witnesses? And let's go back to Representative Paymar. Anything further?
No, Mr. Chair, members, I appreciate you hearing the bill and the good questions. I hope they clarified, Representative Newman. I do think it's reasonable vis-a-vis the employer's consideration, and I think that this is a good step that could not only protect victims, but also to help families who have to endure the cost of losing a loved one and being able to participate in court. So I would, unless there's other questions, you know,
Mr. Chair, Representative, care to answer the question I asked you a little bit ago?
restate the question.
Well, I mean, would the author be willing to consider attorney's fees to be reciprocated to the employer if the case fails?
Mr. Chair, since we're laying the bill over, I'll talk with you about it, and I want to think about it rather than amending the bill at this point.
I guess what I'm getting at is maybe the attorney's fee shouldn't be in there. If it was even both ways, I think I would be comfortable. But I mean, to put that on top of the damages actually incurred, I guess that's kind of where I'm coming from.
It would have been interesting to see what attorney's fees would have been assessed in a favorable judgment against example number one, where the employer was an attorney's office. Representative Nelson.
I guess when we're talking about attorney's fees, right now I think the attorney's fees are in there
to kind of level the playing field, because right now there's a the employer has a lot larger ability to cause havoc in a person's life, and I think without the ability to get attorney's fees if they're going to bring this forward, because they're probably jeopardizing their employment status with that company, they're just going to end up being victimized a second time or a third time, and I think that's to have to say, and we're going to we bring these forward. I don't see people bringing these frivolously forward, and I think that's just a statement.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just very briefly, a comment or a thought. Attorney's fees in a case involving 6 weeks' worth of wages, I don't believe are going to be very great or onerous on an employer, number one. Number two, if you put in the tit-for-tat, attorney's fees going either way, I think it's really going to have a chilling effect on whether or not an employee would come forward with a claim, because they just don't have, they're not going to have as deep a pocket as an employer. So I think you'd really almost defeat the purpose of the bill, and I don't know that that would be a real good idea.
Anything further? Any further discussion? Not Representative Paymar and witnesses, thank you. We'll, Chair, I'll lay the bill over on the table for possible inclusion at a later date.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Ms. DeSalle, Sue DeSalle, State Court Administrator, to complete the overview of the Governor's budget proposal for the court system. While you're getting settled, thanks for coming back. Since we ran out of time yesterday, I appreciate your consideration and help.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Sue DeSalle. I am the State Court Administrator. Yesterday, I think we concluded our budget presentation, but I'm here today really to respond to a request by Representative Murphy, give a little progress report on what we've been doing in the guardian ad litem area. And my technical folk will bring this up in just a minute, but you have, I think, copies of the slides in front of you. Let me start by saying that when we took over from the counties the funding responsibility for the guardian ad litem system, this was in fiscal year 2002, we discovered that that despite the fact that there had been a state and federal mandate for a quarter of a century that there be a guardian ad litem appointed in, I'm going to just shift over here. The guardian ad litem appointed in every case in which a child is abused or alleged to be abused or neglected, that in Minnesota, 40% of our kids had no GAL. They had no one to speak for them. Literally, hundreds and hundreds of kids were going each year without any representation. We also found that we had 53 independent and vastly varying programs around the state. We had guardians ad litem paid from $6 to $65 an hour. We had programs where lay persons were GALs, others that required masters in social work or law degrees. We had extremes of funding, generous in a very few areas, severely underfunded in many. And interestingly enough, we found that one-third of all of guardian ad litem funding was actually being spent on what we call discretionary cases. That is, contentious family law cases, truancy and runaway cases. But these are cases where abuse and neglect of the child were not alleged. And yet again, hundreds and hundreds of kids going out without a GAL in CHIPS and TPR cases. We also found that there was a general lack of training, supervision, and accountability. So over the last 3 years, the judiciary has implemented a fundamental reform in this area. under the leadership of Mark Toogood, who is our state guardian ad litem coordinator and the Conference of Chief Judges. The conference established a clear policy of having well-trained and highly effective guardian ad litems for every child who's abused and neglected in our family or in juvenile courts. And then the conference established judicial district budgets to achieve those statewide priorities. So what have been the outcomes? We have moved from about 60% to nearly 100% representation in abuse and neglect cases. And we have doubled the number of children represented, going from about 4,300 to 8,300 in our what we call our priority one cases, and about 13,000 children overall. And we did this in a number of ways. First, there was new funding in the 2001 session. Standardized the rates of guardians ad litem across the state. You repealed the mandatory requirement for GALs in truancy and runaway cases. And then we reduced the number of GAL appointments in the discretionary cases in family law. And then we took those resources and we applied them to kids in the CHIPS and TPR cases to close this coverage gap. We also have improved the quality assurance, and we've done that by implementing a statewide administrative infrastructure to provide real oversight of the GAL system, its effectiveness, and its efficiency. This is assuring compliance with things like the background checks for all GALs, for their continuing education, and most importantly, that there is a regular evaluation of GAL performance and accountability. Now, in the last 2 years, every paid GAL in the system has undergone two performance reviews. And the first round, the services of 50 GALs were terminated. And in the second round, just this last year, another 16 GALs were dropped. Now, the safety and the future lives of these children can depend on the work of GALs. And that is why that we also are committed to providing continuous quality training for our GALs, and we have also improved our complaint investigation process. In the last several years, there have been over 100 formal complaints filed and investigated, and we have found 95% of those to be non-meritorious. And all of this has resulted, I think it's safe to say, in increased consistency, and we think quality of the services that our GAL system is providing. Now, my report to you today is that we have made very significant strides in improving the GAL system, but we have a overall five-year plan, and we're only midway through that plan. Children's Justice Initiative is a strategic priority for the judiciary, and the GAL reform is one part of that. And our goal is, and our commitment is, to continue to work at improving the GAL system. In the future, we're going to be focusing on quality assurance, making sure that the GAL rules are being complied with, that GALs are being appointed in a timely way and assigned to cases, that the reports that GALs provide to the courts are thorough and fair to the parties and are submitted on time. We are going to be monitoring performance of GALs against benchmarks relating to the number of hours per case and the number of contacts with children throughout. And we're going to have a continued commitment to the investment in the training and development of our GALs. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would stand for any questions.
We'll go to questions right now. I'll just take a moment, though, to welcome a tour group that's come in. And looks like we have the 7th grade students from Farmington Middle School, Farmington, Minnesota. And I might say we don't give out awards as to the best dressed group that's come in, but I must say every one of you looks like you're very well dressed, very well behaved. So the 7th grade students from Farmington Middle School, Farmington, Minnesota, welcome. Very good. We'll go to questioning now. Representative Ellison, then Murphy. Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, Mr. O'Sell, could you tell us a little bit about the geographic spread as it relates to the shortage in GALs? Is this something that the rural areas are suffering with more, or is it in the inner city problem, or is there any rhyme or reason to who's not getting GALs, who needs them?
Mr. Chair and Representative Ellison, we've done, we spent this last 3 years attempting on a statewide basis to increase the GAL coverage, and I think we've done a really remarkable job of that. We have in Hennepin and Ramsey counties, the GAL program includes both paid guardians and volunteers. And we think the volunteer program is a very important part and component of this. But there is sometimes difficulty in recruiting sufficient volunteers. But we're working on that. Our number one priority is to make sure that we have adequate numbers and timely appointments. So I think we've done a good job of looking at this from a statewide perspective.
Okay. Representative Murphy.
I have a couple questions, Mr. Chair. When you're talking about standardizing the pay, and it started out somewhere $6.50 an hour and up to $65, what is the standard pay then now usually?
Mr.
Chair and Representative Murphy, I am going to look to my GAL manager, but I believe it's between $14 and about $21, depending on the educational background and the experience of the individual.
$14 to $21, that's the range.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, the average pay is around $17 an hour, so between $14 and $20 an hour at this point.
And give us your name on the...
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Mark Toogood. I'm the state's guardian ad litem program manager for the State Court Administrator, Sue DeSalle.
Representative Murphy.
And Mr. Chair, Ms. DeSalle, you said that there were 100 complaints and you found that 95 were not meritorious. Were 95% that 95 out of 100 complaints that you found did not have merit? Did the people that made the complaint agree then, after they had worked it out with you, that they were not meritorious?
Mr. Toogood.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, not in every instance. And there is an appeal provision in the complaint procedure where dissatisfied complainants can appeal the finding of the investigation to the chief judge of the judicial district. I would say about 10% of those that were found to be non-meritorious were subsequently appealed to the chief judge.
And
Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Toogood, what about the disposition of those 10% then?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, we dealt with some of the performance concerns that we thought were legitimate by terminating services in some of those instances that was reflected in Ms. DeSalle's numbers about people who were let go. So, just to elaborate, though the complaint itself may not have been meritorious, that doesn't mean that there weren't other performance concerns that we wanted to address. So the complainant may have alleged a particular egregious violation that we didn't find to be true, but that there were sufficient other concerns that we took personnel action against those individuals.
And, Mr. Chair, Mr. Trugard, what about the 5 cases that were found to be meritorious? What happened to those 5 cases?
Mr. Trugard.
Chair, Representative Murphy. I believe in 3 or 4 of those cases, we did terminate the services, and in the other 1 or 2, we placed the guardian ad litem on a remedial plan to get additional training.
Ms. DeSalle, would you care to add to that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, I just wanted to mention, of course, that when we took over the guardian ad litem system in FY02, we brought over everyone that was currently serving. And this is the issue where we're talking about the system we found was undertrained, undersupervised, underfunded, and there were issues. And that's why we have moved to this quality assurance. We have reviewed all the performance of every paid guardian and have taken action where it appeared that the individual was not the right fit for this program. And this is the kind of thing that Mr. Toogood is suggesting to you.
Representative Murphy.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just have a brief overview of what the remedial training is like, or what are the components of that remedial training?
Mr. Toogood.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, thank you for the question. Depending on the kind of complaint that's been lodged, whether it be insensitivity to the dynamics of domestic violence or boundary issues, broadly speaking, on the case, we ask the guardian ad litem to get specific training that addresses those particular concerns. And we have done a lot of work on the domestic violence issue as well as on professional boundaries generally.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Truckett, you ask the person to get training. Do you have specific training that you ask them to go to? Do you provide the expert type of training that's convenient to them?
Mr. Truckett.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, thank you for the question. In some instances, we're able to provide the training directly to the individual, and in other instances, we would refer them to a local training program provided by folks like the Domestic Abuse Intervention Project or some other entity.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a statement rather than a question. I did a third-party petition for custody, as many of you know, and there was a guardian ad litem appointed to look out after Dylan. And as soon as I started talking about it and had some concerns after the process was over, the guardian ad litem program actually came to my office. I didn't request them to come. They were very interested in the concerns that I had and the process that I had experienced, and I believe that they are doing their best to address some of those concerns. Now, that doesn't mean I won't have a bill later, just, you know, as part of a disclosure here, but I just wanted you to know that I do believe that they consider this to be a priority and that they do want to implement the five-year plan that makes this a workable program. I, too, have some concerns because when you're in the middle of a problem, the last thing you want to do is complain about somebody who is going to get to make the decision about where that child should be placed. And that was my biggest concern throughout the process, and I believe that they are working on things to make that better. So thank you, and we'll be talking again later, I'm sure.
Very good. Any other questions from the committee? If not, then thank you, Mr. Sell, Mr. Toogood.
Thank you much, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Very good. We have one remaining bill to consider today, and it's House File 465, Representative De La Forest, regarding interference with ambulance service personnel who are providing emergency care established as a crime. Representative De La Forest, if you'd have a seat, the chair will move your bill to get it before the committee and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It is my understanding that this bill will be laid over for potential inclusion in your omnibus finance bill. Mr. Chairman, members, good morning, particularly Representative Meslow. Welcome back. It is indeed good to see you back here with us. Great circumstances. For the record, my name is Chris De La Forest. I represent District 49A. Mr. Chairman and members, I'm pleased to present House File 465 for your consideration today. Essentially, what this bill does is it affords the same legal protection to paramedic crews that firefighters and police officers already enjoy. If you look at the relevant statutes, the state has decided, and I think rightly so, that firefighters and police officers should be afforded particular protection in the performance of their duties. To give you just a brief history of how I came to be involved in this bill, Rob Snyder, who is an HCMC paramedic, was a constituent of mine, and he called me one day and he said, "Do you know there's a gap in the statutes?" I said, "Okay, tell me about this." He said, well, it's a crime to interfere with a police officer or a firefighter when they're performing their duties, but not a paramedic. We're oftentimes at the same scene. We face the same dangers. Why are we left out? And I said, oh, okay, let me check this out. I hung up the phone, called staff. I said, go find out where we protect paramedics. We can't have this circumstance. We'll find it. Well, my apology was issued about 3 days later when I called him back and said, you're absolutely right. Indeed, we should do that. And so simply the public policy behind my bill is that I believe that since firefighters and paramedics and police officers do face frequently the very same dangers, we have a good public policy to protect the police and firefighters. We should also do the same for our paramedics. In fact, the loophole is such that it is my understanding that even some paramedics are covered but not others. For example, if a paramedic is employed by, say, the Minneapolis Fire Department, that paramedic is protected under the firefighter definition. So it's really a paramedic who perhaps is employed by HCMC or a line of health care who isn't protected. So, in fact, it's a situation where only certain paramedics are not protected. Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure how you would like to proceed. I could either stand for questions, or I do have Mr. Snyder and Representative Powell and O.J. Doyle who would just like to make some very brief remarks on behalf of this bill, and however you wish to proceed.
Any questions right now of the author? If not, why don't we have your witnesses down and see, and take a couple minutes from each and then see if we have additional questions. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I would note that this bill, I believe, was heard last session and included in last year's Judiciary Finance Omnibus Bill. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Have there been any changes since we heard in advance the bill last year?
The bill has not changed, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Let's hear from your witness.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members, and thank you for having me here this morning. You have to forgive me in advance. I'm recovering from a cold, so if I get a little crankly, you'll understand. Just like Representative Dale Escort said, I brought this to
your
attention.
I'm sorry, we're audio records, so give us your full name and then go
ahead.
I'm
very sorry. My name is Robert Snyder.
Go ahead.
As Mr. or Representative Dale Escort commented, I did bring this bill to his attention, and after an incident happened to my partner and I, we were on scene. We responded to a victim of a bicycle accident. We arrived at scene, and she was an intoxicated female that was leaving a bar, riding a bicycle, and she had fallen, struck her head, and had a serious head injury. As we attempted to treat this patient, we moved her to the back of the ambulance. We were treating her in the back of the ambulance, preparing for a transport when an unknown male entered our ambulance and tried to remove the victim from our ambulance. Apparently, this was a fellow bar patron that had got to know this young lady, and he felt that he could take care of her and that she didn't need our services. As he was unknown to us and actually unknown to our patient. She didn't recall who he was. We initiated our call for help. At this time, he kept trying to remove the victim from our ambulance, stating that he could offer her services by taking care of her at his house or whatnot. We came in between the patient and him, removed him from our ambulance, held him at bay, and we made an emergency request for the police. They responded to the scene. He attempted to flee, and they actually chased him down and arrested him. When it came to prosecuting him, the city attorney called me up and said, gee, you know, we really understand what's going on. We're going to prosecute this, but we're going to charge him with disorderly conduct. He goes, it's really unfortunate that you're not a firefighter or a police officer because the statute does not apply to you. And that's when I contacted Representative Dale Forrest, and he's been very responsive to my concerns. And I hope that the committee members could see the importance of kind of equalizing the inadequacy of the justice system in that aspect.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder, for your testimony. Any questions? Thank you. You can be excused. Appreciate you coming here.
Thank you.
Did you have any other witnesses?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Powell.
Give us your name and then proceed.
Representative Duke Powell. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. And I'm going to be very brief. This simply acknowledges that EMS personnel who in the performance of their duties as public safety personnel deserve the same protection as the police and fire. It's only applicable when they're rendering care in accordance with current law. And I think the important thing here is this, is that it's the responsibility of our ambulance providers to care and protect the patient. any actions by a third party that potentially endangers a patient is a public safety matter. And so I'm certainly appreciative of Representative DeLaForest for bringing this bill forward and also for Mr. Snyder for bringing the matter up. So thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Doyle, would you come down and take a minute or two? Tell us your name, who you're representing, and why this bill is good or not.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is O.J. Doyle. I'm here on behalf of Minnesota Ambulance Association, which represents private, public, fire, police-based ambulance services, both paid and personnel throughout the state of Minnesota. We supported this bill last session and appreciate its inclusion in the omnibus bill. Unfortunately, it didn't make it all the way through to the end. We think that the protection of our personnel is probably one of the most important aspects of the job. And a lot of times, people take for granted what the ambulance crews are doing and don't understand that it can be just as dangerous as it is for police and firefighters. We have periodically, over the past probably 10 years, we've had two or three ambulance personnel have been killed in the line of duty, one most recently about a month ago in northern Minnesota. So it is a dangerous job, and we'd appreciate it being treated like the other members of the Public Safety Network. Thank you very much.
Very good. Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chair, quick question. Mr. Doyle, do you know how many cases we're talking about? I was just looking at the fiscal note, and I was trying to figure out how they determined the cost of implementing the bill with increased prison beds, but do you track the assaults or interference over people on an annual basis to come up with this number?
Mr. Doyle.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Paymar, we don't have a formalized tracking system. A lot of issues where situations arise where there's confrontations, we try and work it out amicably without going any further than that. I don't have any records, but I know that I could bring in just about every one of the 15,000 certified ambulance personnel in the state, and they could all give you a story. This tends to be a pretty independent group, and I don't see this being hugely used. It's fairness, and it's also, we hope, it'll serve as a deterrent.
Anything else? I don't see anything. Representative DeLaForest, the chair will lay the bill over on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill later on.
Mr. Chairman and members, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next meeting is Tuesday the 22nd, and that's going to conclude it for today. I'd like to thank the young ladies and gentlemen from Farmington again. We normally run until 12 o'clock, but our business is conducted, and we're going to leave as you're leaving. If there's nothing further, this meeting is adjourned.